Now it's turned on. Okay. Now I have to speak a little bit less loud, right? So this is part of the Grand Ontario tour. Actually, this is my third part of a lecture series, which took me at least through a part of Ontario. Some people assured me it's a smaller part of Ontario, so I call it now the Small Ontario Tour. And what I wanted to do with this lecture series is introduce this field of quantum optomechanics, talk about the state of play in the field, the challenges in the field, and also the prospects of the field, both for addressing fundamental challenges in the foundations of quantum theory, but also addressing potential interesting applications for both optical information processing and a couple of other things, as I hope I can tell you during my talk. So just to give you what I'm trying to do is, of course, I will try to sneak in content of all of this, all of the other talks that I gave also. So it will be a mix of talking about fundamental experiments that can possibly be done with these mechanical systems at the interface between quantum physics and gravity, talking a little bit about the possibility to exploit those systems for quantum information processing, and eventually today's talk really bridging the gap from quantum foundations to new technologies, both classical and quantum. So here is now the title of today's talk, Schrödinger's Mirrors from Quantum Foundations to New Quantum Technologies. One of the many nice things about working in Vienna is, besides of the beautiful coffee houses you can do your physics in, both Ephraim and John will agree that these are great occasions for great physics discussions, is also that at our university we have in the fourth floor the Central Library of Physics, which hosts the Schrödinger Archive. So you can go there, and you can browse in the letters of Erwin Schrödinger. Yeah, it's very nice, and every now and then I do that, and I every now and then discover some very interesting letters and writings. And one of the things that I found already some time ago is a letter that Albert Einstein wrote to Erwin Schrödinger in August 1935. So this letter is interesting for several reasons. Let's just have a look at it. So I will read that to you. So it starts with, "Dear Schrödinger, you are in fact the only human with whom I really like to discuss." And then he goes on a little bit why this is the case, and he says, "Although in our expectations of where to go, we are the strongest antipodes." And this sets the stage for this letter. So this letter is meant to be an introduction to a discussion of the very foundations of quantum physics. It's about the meaning of the wave function. So the wave function is the central element in quantum theory, and the big question is, well, what does this psi actually mean, this wave function? And this is what the letter was about. And Einstein wrote this letter telling Schrödinger, look, your view of the wave function is actually a little bit too realistic. Okay? And I give you an example where your point of view fails. So don't be afraid, I will read the relevant parts to you. It's just a proof that he really wrote that. Okay, so Einstein says, look, here's an example. Let's take a system. So he says the system is a substance in a chemically metastable equilibrium. For example, a chunk of gunpowder. Chunk of gunpowder which can inflame itself via inner forces. And the average lifetime is on the order of a year. In the beginning, the psi function characterizes a sufficiently well-defined macroscopic state of the system. Your equation, he writes to Schrödinger, so the Schrödinger equation, your equation, however, takes care that after a year or so, this is not any longer the case. After this year, the psi function describes a sort of mixture of not yet exploded and already exploded system. Okay? So it sounds familiar already. No? So suddenly you create, as Einstein said, a sort of mixture of between being exploded and being unexploded. By no art of interpretation can this psi function be made an adequate description of the real factual situation. Why? Well, because in reality, there is no such thing between being exploded and not exploded. So there's a problem. If you take the psi function as something too realistic, you end up in a situation. And in November 35, Schrödinger published his first paper in a series on, the current situation of quantum theory. And basically, we know the analog of this example as the well-known Schrödinger cat example. So here's the Schrödinger cat, which is the this is the quantum optics version. Okay? So the quantum optics version is you have a single photon, you impinge it on a beam splitter. Behind the beam splitter, quantum theory tells you that the photon is in a superposition, and you have this evil device. And if you just continue to do this experiment, you will end up in an entangled state which contains the cat in a healthy state and in a less healthy state. And this is what Schrödinger meant, what Einstein meant when he said, by no art of interpretation can this psi function be made an adequate description of the real factual situation. Because in reality, there's no such thing between being alive and dead. And this is one of the big challenges in experimental physics is to realize experiments where such, as we call them, macroscopic superposition states. So states of a physical system that have superpositions of two macroscopically distinct states, to realize those in an experiment. This is one of the big motivations in this field of optomechanics, to answer the question, is it possible that we can actually take such huge systems like cantilevers, here hundreds of microns large, and by means of some quantum manipulation, produce superpositions of, let's say, two completely different center of mass states, for example. So the center of mass of this cantilever being here and here. Or superpositions of a particle, a trapped particle, being here or here. Yeah? So this is one of the main motivations of this field of pursuing mechanical systems in the quantum regime. Another motivation goes back to realizing that mechanical systems are beautiful sensors. Here's a very intriguing example by the group of Dan Ruger. This is a nuclear magnetic resonance experiment where the sample that you want to investigate, in that case it's a tobacco mosaic virus, is just glued or integrated here at the bottom of a mechanical cantilever. So here's the cantilever, so it can swing. And you put the sample here, which has a lot of hydrogen atoms, onto this cantilever. You swing it over a magnetic tip. And what you get now is, because you besides this static magnetic field that basically lifts the degeneracy of your nuclear wave function, you lift the degeneracy of the spin states, and you drive now here with an additional magnetic field, you drive spin flips of your nuclear spins in this biological samples. So this cantilever now swings over this magnetic field here, and while it swings, every now and then you hit a resonance and you get a spin flip of a nucleus, and the cantilever just gets kicked. Okay? So you oscillate it over this tip, and you get, for every time you get a spin flip, you get random kicks of your cantilever. And by just monitoring now the motion of this cantilever, you can reconstruct in 3D the full virus. That's what they did. And the fascinating part about that is, compared to conventional NMR techniques that you're used to in the hospital or so, because you do that on a tip of a tiny microfabricated cantilever, the volume sensitivity that you get is 100 million times better than we are used to today. Okay? And if you look in the literature and look at current capabilities in mechanical sensing, it's really amazing. So single electron spin detection, single nuclear spin detection, I basically already showed you. This has been done by the group of Dan Ruger. We have displacement sensitivities on the order of atometers. This is the sensitivities that you get today in gravitational wave interferometers. We have force sensitivities on a zeptonewton scale. We have mass sensitivities on a yoctogram scale. And here comes an even more intriguing point. All those sensitivities, all these numbers that I give you here, are numbers that you achieve with purely classical harmonic oscillators. So these numbers here are basically limited due to the fact that you have an harmonic, classic harmonic oscillator that is thermally vibrating. So it's a very it's a natural question to ask now, where could you push those numbers, in which regime could you push these numbers if you are not any longer dealing with classical harmonic oscillators that are thermally vibrating, but if you enter the quantum regime of those mechanical systems and maybe even are capable of generating squeeze states of such mechanical systems where you basically can gain orders of magnitude in sensitivity of displacement. So these are another set of questions why people have started to look into the quantum regime of mechanical systems. Here comes my last motivation. The last motivation is based on the realization that when you have such mechanically, so microfabricated mechanical systems, that you can functionalize them. So you have a cantilever, so something that vibrates, and you put a mirror on top, you couple to light. You put something conducting on top, you couple to charge. You put a magnet on top, you couple to spin, and so on and so on. So you have a device that now, just by functionalizing it with some additional material, can couple to different physical systems. So the idea is now the following. If you manage to couple, for example, your light via the mirror on top to a mechanical mode coherently in the quantum regime, and at the same time coherently couple the mechanical mode to, let's say, a magnetic flux, for example, then you have a possibility to couple photons of any wavelength, for example, to a magnetic flux quantum system without the necessity to directly interact, but you can do that via a mechanical transducer. Okay? So mechanical systems can act wonderfully as a transducer to make different physical quantum systems interact where they normally wouldn't have any interface for interaction. And there have been several proposals in the literature. We don't have time to go into the details. Maybe just one possibility here. Peter Rabel, in the time in the group of Michel Lukian, had this beautiful proposal that if you were to couple an array of individual spins, so let's say you deposit individual spin systems, for example, via NV centers in the surface of some bulk material. So they sit far apart, they cannot talk to each other. And what you could do is now you could have a cantilever, come close to it. On the cantilever is a magnetic tip. And now what you get is, due to the field gradient here, you get a position-dependent Siemens splitting of your two-level system. So that means now that the spin couples to the mechanical motion. That is one way of realizing now this direction here. And then you can have an array of mechanical systems that are, for example, capacitively coupled to each other. And that is then a way how to achieve long-range spin-spin interactions in such a solid-state system. So that is one of the possibilities. There are many others that are currently being worked out in the literature. And just to, again, reassure you that this is not complete bogus, and this is basically 10, 20 years away. Here's a classical example which shows you the benefit of mechanical systems. This is a system that IBM started to build back in around 2000. It's built on an idea of Dan Ruger to fabricate a mechanically based memory device. The idea is you have an array of cantilevers. They can collectively move, but they move across a polymer surface. Each of the cantilevers can basically deflect and imprint in the polymer matrix a hole. The hole is then a one. Right? So it can be read out capacitively, so the needle here also knows whether there's a hole below it or not. Then this thing collectively moves, so it can write holes. Essentially, each of the cantilevers can address a 100 by 100 bit array. And the tip can also be heated. So if you want to erase the information, you just lower the tip, heat it up, and the polymer is again flat. Yeah? So you have a read-write mechanical memory element with a 1 terabit per square inch storage density. Yeah? These things exist. I already held one in my hands. This has the size of an SD card, and it works. Yeah? So that's already possible. Still in the classical regime, but I just would like to point out with that this is one of the intriguing aspects of working with microfabricated structures, that you have this huge range of capabilities with respect to functionalizing them and to also scaling them up. Okay, so if you now want to take this quantum business seriously, then somehow you need to couple now mechanical devices to quantum systems. And this is what's being done right now in many quantum optics labs and solid-state physics labs around the world. And I just give you a couple of examples. So what you can do is you can couple your mechanical system to charge, for example, by building a capacitor where one of the plates is moving. And here is an experiment that has been performed at Caltech, from the Rukes and the Schwab group, where you have a nanomechanical beam that is capacitively coupled to a single electron Cooper pair box. So to a superconducting Cooper pair box. This is one possibility. Another possibility I already pointed out, you take a cantilever, put a magnet on top, and then you can couple to spin, and there have been a couple of beautiful experiments in that direction. You can put a mirror on a cantilever and just couple to the momentum transfer of a photon. So photon comes in, is reflected, kicks the mirror. That's another possibility. You can also have, there was a beautiful experiment by the group of John Martinez and Andrew Cleland, UCSB. You can have aluminum nitride piezoelectric material and couple it capacitively to a superconducting phase qubit. This was the first experiment that demonstrated a quantum system, controllable single qubit quantum system coupled to a mechanical device. Or you can think about having ultra-cold atoms coupled to mechanical systems. You can also think of having ultra-cold atoms as mechanical systems. Yeah? Look at the collective motion. So all these things you can do. And what I would like to focus on in the last 5 minutes of my talk is is actually this aspect here of optomechanics. So really the photon interacting with the mechanics. So one last thing. If I talk about mechanical systems in the quantum regime and about how important it is as a goal, then several of you should stand up now and say, whoa, wait a minute, this is old hat. I mean, this has been done 20 years ago, and we all know that. And why do we know that? Well, because we do have trapped ion quantum computing. And it is actually the collective quantum motion, so the quantum regime of the collective motion of the string of ions, that enables us to have interactions between individual spins of these ions here in an ion chain. So each of these atoms in such a trapped ion quantum interface are addressed individually with a laser beam. And the way they couple with each other, and this is actually the content of the seminal paper by Sirac and Zolla, is by exploiting the mechanical collective motion of the string of ions as a quantum transducer. Yeah? So mechanical systems in a quantum regime, this is where it has been done and exploited to the level of exactly what I told you. And in the rest of what I'm going to tell you, I will simply make blatant use of all the concepts that these guys have heroically developed in their research. And we apply those concepts now to the collective motion of not a few atoms, but of 10 to the 10, 10 to the 15, up to 10 to the 20 atoms. Okay? That is the point. And this is what I want to show you. Okay, so here is my very brief outline of what I would like to highlight now in the rest. I give a brief introduction to the working principles of quantum optomechanics. I would like to briefly talk about the fundamental questions, and then finally about the give and take relation of fundamental questions and the development of new technologies. So here's almost everything in a nutshell. Super short summary of what an optical cavity does. What is an optical cavity? So here you have our mechanical system. And I told you what we really want to exploit is the fact that you have a mechanical system and a photon comes now, hits my mechanical system and kicks it. You see within 30 seconds on a back on the of the envelope calculation that the effect of a single photon on such a cantilever like that is completely negligible. So if you calculate the wave function of your mechanical oscillator before the photon hit and after the photon has hit, it's essentially the same. Okay? Which, by the way, is good news for Ephraim, because this is the reason why his single photon experiments work. Because the photon does not get entangled with the mirror of which it is reflected from. Okay? So that's why you can see nice interference fringes. Of course, for me, that's bad, because I would like to be in the opposite regime. So the trick that you play is, instead of having a single photon reflecting once, you have a second mirror here. So this one is highly reflecting, the mechanical system. This one is highly reflecting, so you have two mirrors. And now the single photon just bounces back and forth many times, and you enhance the momentum transfer onto your mechanical system. And then you play another trick. You don't even have a single photon here, but it just comes with 10 to the 10 photons, just to increase the effect a little bit more. Okay? But that's minor details. That's not so not so important. But I tell you the two main effects that happen. The first one is, so this optical resonator has a beautiful feature. If light comes here, and if the length of this of this optical resonator here, of this cavity, is actually a multiple of the wavelength that comes in, then you get resonant enhancement of the light inside this cavity. So if you plot here the amplitude of the light inside the cavity, then you get a maximum when your cavity length is a multiple of your wavelength. Okay? It's just classical constructive interference. Now, the light that goes in is reflected, and we know that the phase of the light that is reflected depends very much on where the light is reflected. Okay, so the phase of the light that comes out will depend on whether the mirror was here, here, or here. Okay, but if I crank up now my laser power and I crank up the intracavity intensity, the radiation pressure will just push my mechanical system away. That means that the phase of the light that comes out of the cavity is shifted. And the more I crank up the power, the larger is the phase shift. So now I make a black box around what I just said. I have a black box, I send light in, and the light that comes out experiences an intensity-dependent phase shift. Well, if you ask all the optics people here in the audience what's in the black box, they will all tell you, oh, a nonlinear optical medium, normally a crystal. Intensity-dependent phase shift is what a CAM medium does for you. So in other words, such a cavity with a moving mechanical boundary behaves like an optical nonlinearity. So you can modify, due to the mechanical motion, actually, or the optomechanical action, you can modify the properties of the light in a nonlinear fashion. That is really super. The second thing that happens, second fundamental interaction, is if you now detune your cavity slightly. So basically, you're sitting somewhere here now. Okay, you're sitting at a regime where the slight changes of the cavity length lead to large changes in the intracavity intensity. What's the consequence of that? Well, if the mirror moves a little bit, so if the cavity length changes, let's say in that direction, the intracavity intensity changes, the radiation pressure gets more. If it moves in the other direction, the intracavity intensity gets less, the radiation pressure gets less. So I just introduced to you now, just by detuning slightly our cavity, a position-dependent force. That's now physics 101. I have an harmonic oscillator. I add a position-dependent force to the harmonic oscillator. I change the spring constant. That's what's called an optical spring. I can optically change the spring constant of the mechanics. There's a second effect. If you change here the cavity length, then the change in intensity in the inside the cavity does not occur instantaneously, because it's an interference effect. Remember, so if I very quickly change the length of my cavity, it will take a finite time until the intracavity intensity reaches again the new value where it's supposed to be. So you get a delay. So that means that my position-dependent force that I just talked about is retarded in time. So again, physics 101, I have a harmonic oscillator, I have a force that is proportional to the position, it's retarded in time. Position retarded in time for an oscillator is momentum, so I have a force now that couples to the momentum of the oscillator. So a momentum-dependent force, which means I can change my my damping. Okay? So now I have everything. I just told you how I can optically change the light properties, because I have the mechanically change the light properties by the optical nonlinearity, and I told you how I can optically change everything about the mechanical susceptibility, namely the real part, the spring constant, and the imaginary part, the damping. So I have everything now. I can do with my optomechanical interface, I have now full control over the optical and the mechanical properties. Okay? And now the rest, what I have to do is I have to just take it into the quantum regime. And there have been many, many important experiments. Braginsky was actually the first one to realize that, but we don't have time to go into the details here. Okay? So here's the quantum picture, just for the quantum optics guys among you. Another way of seeing what I just said is, in frequency space, here's your cavity. If you're detuned with your cavity, so you pump your cavity, let's say, red detuned, then the only way to scatter photons into the cavity is by getting some extra energy. Where does the energy come from? Well, the energy comes from the mechanical system, if you're detuned here by the mechanical frequency. So what I get now is I get a coherent exchange of energy between the photons in the cavity and the mechanical system. And in two more quantum optics, that's known as a beam splitter interaction. Okay? Number one. Number two, if I pump my cavity now on the blue side, same argument. The only way to scatter photons into the cavity is by, in that case, now get rid of some energy. Where does the energy go to? Well, I can dump it into the mechanical system. Means in that case, what I can actually generate is a joint excitation of photons in the cavity and phonons in my resonator. Two-mode quantum optics, this is also very well known, that's called a two-mode squeezing or down-conversion interaction. That's what is able to generate entanglement between light and mechanics. Okay? That's it. Now I have the two most elementary interactions between my optical mode and my mechanical mode, and with this interaction, I can do everything. I now have a full quantum optics toolbox to control and manipulate mechanical states in a quantum regime by controlling optical quantum states. Okay? That's super. So once we realized that, we were very excited, and this is where we really started to get going. Of course, there are a couple of challenges, and as I said, I don't want to go now in all the details. It's very interesting to realize that one of the challenges is, of course, you need to start at a sufficiently pure mechanical state in order to be able to exploit those unitary operations, quantum operations. And that's why you need to cool the mechanical motion ideally close to the quantum ground state. Okay? This has been done in a couple of works. And also, you would like to operate in a regime where the coupling rate, the interaction rate, the drive these interactions here is larger than all the decoherence rates in the system. That's called the strong coupling regime. And this has also been achieved in independent experiments. And right now, the community is really trying to do is to combine those two requirements into one experiment and really drive then quantum optical control of mechanical systems. Maybe I just give you here a couple of examples. So I think that might be a better one. So just to show you how something like that works. So here's an example of that's a work by the Painter group. This was performed at Caltech, this experiment. So here you have a so-called photonic crystal cavity. So this is a nanomechanical beam that is fabricated in the surface layer of an SOI wafer. And what you do is you perforate this beam, so you modulate the innings of refraction, and you do it in such a way that you get a Bragg condition, so constructive interference both for the electromagnetic waves and for the acoustic waves. And then you insert a tiny bit of distortion from the periodicity, which leads to a localization of the optical mode on in the center of the beam and of the acoustic mode in the center of the beam. So the optical photons and the mechanical phonons are co-localized in the center of this beam, and this beam can now vibrate, so it can acoustically vibrate with gigahertz frequency. This changes the cavity response, and therefore you have an optomechanical interaction, because you have now actually mechanical dependence on the cavity frequency. And what you can do now is you take this thing, you put it into a cryostat, and you come with an optical fiber. And with this is optical fiber taper, so the fiber is thinned out to below the wavelength of the light, such that the laser light now propagates evanescently, so outside of the fiber core, and you can couple that in now into this nanomechanical beam, or into this cavity. And then the only thing you do is you turn a knob, and you basically radically detune now the laser frequency with respect to the cavity frequency. That's the only thing you need to do, because remember, beam split interaction, photons are now scattered into the cavity on cost of some phonons, so they take energy away from the phonons, and they immediately leave the cavity again, because you have a finite cavity decay rate, and they take the energy with them. So for the atomic physicists among you, this is resonantly enhanced anti-Stokes scattering. Yeah, so everything is very well known, just applied to a different system. Okay, then you do that, and you start from around 100 quanta, from about 3.5 gigahertz, more than 20k, and you go down to the quantum ground state of this system. Yeah, that's how it's done. And then you can have many other systems. This I already showed you. This is this aluminum nitride beam coupled to the qubit. And here, for example, this is essentially a capacitor plate that is fabricated as a membrane and that modulates now the capacitance of an LC circuit. And this is nothing else than a cavity at microwave frequencies. And you can do the very same physics. So not only for optical photons, but you can also do it for microwave photons. Okay. And here's a sort of summary of all the different systems that are right now being explored. And I would like to point out one fascinating aspect. So you can do that, as I said, with the collective motion of atoms inside optical cavities, like 10 to the 5 atoms collectively moving as one harmonic oscillator. But you can also do it with kilogram scale mirrors for gravitational wave detectors. Okay? These are also cavities. And then you have a little bit more laser power, a couple of kilowatts. Well, who cares? The coupling mechanism is one and the same. As long as you don't burn your mirror, you can do beautiful experiments. And you can also, for example, have a cavity with a membrane inside. So Jack Harris at Yale, for example, has been done beautiful experiments. You can have a toroid where basically you launch light in here and you get light going around here in circles. So basically whispering gallery modes. You have total internal reflection and the radiation pressure starts to introduce some breathing modes of this toroidal systems. Tobias Kippenberg has been a pioneer in that field, and so on and so on. Yeah? So that's what you can do. And the fascinating part is now the following. The fascinating part is that we have one and the same universal coupling mechanism, radiation pressure-induced modifications of mechanics inside optical cavities, but we have systems that we can manipulate in a mass regime that basically spans 20 orders of magnitude. That leads to an interesting question. So if we really are able to do what I said in the very beginning, maybe use that to produce a superposition state of a system being here and there, and crank up the mass, couldn't we now enter a regime where the mass of the quantum system itself starts to play a role? Wouldn't that be a new parameter regime for quantum experiments where the gravity of the quantum object itself could start playing a role, and where you could start testing really the interface between quantum physics and gravity. Yeah, so this is the motivation. And let me just very, very briefly give you one possible example. So there are many beautiful, really beautiful experiments of quantum systems in the presence of gravity. This is my absolute favorite. So that's an experiment by Colela, Oberhaus, and Werner, the so-called COW experiment, C-O-W, after the initials, the COW experiment. And what they showed is that when you have a neutron and interferometer, and you rotate the neutron interferometer in the Earth's gravitational field, then you get a gravitationally induced phase shift. That is something that is well known in quantum physics, that when you have a quantum system and you apply an external field, an external classical field that couples to your system, that you get an additional phase to your wave function. And then the interferometer probes this phase. And this is what's been done. And the point is now that in these experiments, the quantum system acts as a test mass in an external gravitational field. And there are some other experiments in the same direction, like this atomic fountain measurements of gravitational gradients is an example. There are other beautiful examples, experiments that demonstrate gravitationally bound states of neutrons, so energy eigenstates of neutrons and spectroscopy and so on. But in all of these experiments, they have in common that the quantum system is a test mass in an external classical gravitational field. I would like to ask the question, what about if the mass of my quantum system now is so large that you have to take into account the gravitational force of the object itself? And that brings me to something which you can call the Gretchenfrage, namely, does gravity need to be quantized? And you can have different opinions on that. Some people think gravity is completely different, and therefore, no, you cannot quantize it all. That's one legitimate position to take, but then you have to live with the consequences. And one of the consequences, if you take that position, is that you will end up at some point in some intrinsic inconsistency in this apparatus. So at some point, a classical field theory will clash with the structure of a quantum theory, and at this transition regime, something is going to happen, which is either inconsistent with quantum theory or inconsistent with classical theory. And one way to deal with that has been proposed by Dioshi already in the 80s. He wondered how he can sort of peacefully, how a classical gravitational field theory can peacefully coexist with a Schrödinger equation. And he borrowed actually concepts from the old days in electromagnetism when people tried to quantize Maxwell's equations or the electromagnetic field. And essentially, what you do is you can treat your gravitational field semi-classically, and what you end up with if you do that and combine it with a Schrödinger equation is that you end up in a nonlinear Schrödinger equation. Because so the sort of physical intuition in quotation marks is that the psi function then in your Schrödinger equation essentially describes the mass density that sources the gravitational field of your object. Full stop. But here I'm just repeating what is sort of the context of that. Okay, but what would be the consequences? A nonlinear Schrödinger equation has a nice feature, it has solitonic solutions, which means that you get a wave packet that doesn't disperse anymore. And that was, by the way, the reason why Dioshi introduced that in the literature. He wanted to provide an answer to the question, why do macroscopic objects don't disperse when they sit there in time? Okay? Now, let's take an example. Let's assume you have an object with 10 to the 10 AMU, atomic mass units. You have a wave packet to the size of 500 nanometers. Then the time it takes for the dispersion of this wave packet to stop is on the order of 30,000 seconds. Okay? So that's a little bit long. But what you could do actually is you could increase the mass a little bit to 10 to the 12 atomic mass units. You could reduce the size of the wave packet a little bit to 500 femtometers, and you would end up in, let's say, in inhibition times of the dispersion on the order of microseconds. And that is a regime that is actually experimentally not completely unfeasible. So can one reach something like that, 10 to the 12 AMUs and 500 femtometer? Answer is yes. Take an object with radius of 400 nanometers, so like micron-sized ball, trap it somehow in an external trap at a megahertz frequency, and, well, cool its motion down to the quantum ground state. Okay. How one does that, I already told you. You use optomechanics. You take the object, trap it in some external trap, and place a cavity around it. And then just play the trick that I just showed you. You take a laser beam, red detune it from the cavity, blah, 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 and then you cool the object. The center of mass motion. Okay, so that is sort of a possibility to enter that regime. And here, I give you just a quick glimpse in our lab. So here we are building an optical cavity. We can put particles in here between 20 nanometers and a few micrometers. Cavity has a large finesse, 100,000. And what you see here, you trap inside the standing wave of the cavity, we trap individual particles, and if you work a little bit harder, instead of a string, you can have then single particles. So in that case, that's a single silica particle on the order of 250 nanometers that stands there. And now you can have, inside the cavity, and now you can have a second optical beam pumping the cavity. Okay? And that you detune now. And so down here is actually, here's a sketch. Here's the cavity resonance, and this one shows now the beam that pumps the cavity. And you see, if you pump the cavity, then you get these little side bands here, and these side bands come from the mechanical motion of my system. So we do really have here optomechanical interaction at work. And if you scan now over, you see if you red detuned, only this one is enhanced. If you blue detuned, only that one is enhanced. So in the one case, you extract energy that gives rise to the side bands, and the other case, you deposit energy. Rise to the side bands. Okay, so this is actually the sort of regime now where you have optomechanical interaction. It should be able to cool. So that's what we are trying to do at the moment. To make a long story short, here is temperature. Versus doesn't matter the damping in our system. And what you see is that we start around 300 Kelvin, and by ramping up now our coupling strength, so the laser power, we cool our mechanical motion down. To, in that case, only a factor of 6, but it has some technical reasons. Right now, we cannot go below 4 millibar in the background pressure. That's another topic. I'm very happy to discuss that. We are also doing a different experiment in collaboration with Ray Chow at the UC Merced, where instead of having a small particle, we just take a centimeter lead sphere. We levitate it magnetically. So we have two coils, an anti-Helmholtz coil configuration. We levitate it in that field. Everything is it's 200 millikelvin, so everything is superconducting. And then you put two additional coils here, and these are just two resonators, like two cavities. This one you drive at a certain frequency, and you detune the drive frequency a little bit with respect to the resonance frequency of that coil. The mechanical motion modulates the mutual inductance, and you get the very same physics. You get side bands mediated by the mechanical motion, and you should get resonantly enhanced flux scattering and should be able to take out energy of that system. So that's work in progress. We are working hard. It's a hard experiment. Okay. So finally, let me very briefly, the last 2 minutes or so, and of course, you can imagine there are many other things that you could also think about. So one of the things I don't tell you about because there's no time is there's also a possibility that with these mechanical systems and quantum regime, we're able to test some predictions of quantum gravity. So for example, there's a chance to observe deviations of the mechanical commutator relation that is predicted by some theories conjectured by some theories of quantum gravity. But that's another topic. Okay, final comment on one of really, for me, the biggest insights that I made during my whole career, that it was always the case that new technologies gave rise to completely new abilities in our experiments that led then to new possibilities for testing quantum physics in a way that has not been possible like 30 years ago. In turn, once you start doing these new experiments, fundamental experiments, you hit new boundaries, and you need to further develop the technologies that you actually use in your lab. Turns out, what comes out as a result are new applications, and new technologies that give back feedback new technologies again, hopefully that lead then to new fundamental experiments. And I just give you a few examples what happened in the case of optomechanics. So here, both at the EPFL, so in Lausanne, the group of Tobias Kippenberg and the group of Oscar Painter at Caltech, they actually came up with a beautiful analogy in optomechanical systems called optomechanically induced transparency. So that's an analogy to electromagnetically induced transparency in atomic physics, where by interference phenomena, you can actually generate a very narrow band transparency window in the transmission through an atomic system, in that case through an optical cavity. And what that leads to is to the possibility to actually modify the dispersion relation of the cavity medium, which means that you can slow light, for example, and which means that if you have a whole array of such systems that show this electromagnetically or optomechanically induced transparency, you can build a mechanically based memory for pulses of light. Yeah, so that is one of the things that, in particular, the Painter group is working on, that you make an integrated array of these optomechanical crystals, 2D on a chip, fiber coupled, and if you get the conditions right, you should be able to store mechanically pulses of light. Another example, also based on mechanically induced transparency, has recently been put forward by the group of Eugene Polzig at the Niels Bohr Institute in Copenhagen. So they demonstrated that one can actually, by coupling a microwave circuit with an optomechanical system, you can actually achieve a noiseless optical readout of electronic signals by exploiting this fact that at this transparency window optomechanically induced transparency, your noise essentially is very strongly suppressed. Another example, a completely different domain, goes back to the Painter group, that essentially took such an optomechanical cavity and just attached a very large mass to it. And you see, here at this interface is your optical cavity, essentially. So you have two photonic crystal cavities and an evanescent field coupling those two cavities with each other, and this coupling is now very sensitive to this gap. And if this one is now a suspended mass, and you start moving this whole thing, then just because of the inertia of the mass here, you see that the gap will change. And what you get is an extremely accurate sensor for acceleration. And what they demonstrated is an on-chip fiber-coupled sensor with sensitivities in the micro-G per root hertz regime, really a large bandwidth, low power, optical power consumption, and using this optomechanical effect, you can actually tune the performance of this device. So this is really a new generation of sensors that is being enabled there. So the final example that I would like to give comes from our lab. That has been a recent discovery, a recent insight that we made. The point is, what we've been studying is those mechanically moving mirrors as boundary condition for our optomechanical effects, and it turns out that these mirrors that we are using for our optomechanical cavities have superior performance when you use them as optical coatings. So what we did recently in a collaboration with Jun Yi at Boulder was we used some of our essentially cantilever materials, put it on a mirror, used the mirror in a optical cavity, and could show that the noise performance of this cavity is actually an order of magnitude better than what you can normally achieve with regular coatings. And the reason being that the mechanical properties of this coating exceeds the mechanical properties of the coatings that we have today in our labs. Why is this important? Well, it's important because if you want to detect gravitational waves, you need to very accurately measure the distance between two masses down to the level of relative length changes of 10 to the minus 21. And the bound that you actually get right now for the sensitivity of those devices is due to the Brownian motion of these coatings. So actually, the performance of a 4 kilometer long interferometer is limited by the Brownian motion of a 5 micron thick coating. Okay? And by improving the mechanical properties according to the fluctuation dissipation theorem, if you reduce the dissipation, the fluctuation will get smaller. And this is what we did. And so that's why the sensitivity should eventually be better. And also, by the way, if you build super lasers, the best lasers today have a 40 millihertz line width. They are limited right now by, again, the very same thing, the Brownian motion of the coating. So actually using now our knowledge and developments from optomechanics, we can feed that back into the laser technology and hopefully at some day build lasers that even have a better line width and therefore even better sensitivity than lasers today. So wrapping up, I actually took you through a tour de force of optomechanics, I hope I could convince you that adding quantum to mechanics really is fun and has several potential applications in the field of quantum foundations, quantum information, and quantum measurement. I would like to thank at this stage my collaborators, in particular at that stage Ray Chow and Clemens Hamara and Oriol Romero Izard, and from what I showed today, also Junyi's group. And this is my group. We have Gary Cole, who is responsible for this low noise coatings and the microfab. Nikolai Kiesel, Rainer Kaltmeng, and Steve Minter are responsible for the levitation experiments. I didn't show you our experiments on the test of quantum gravity. We have here Sungkun Hong and Michael Wenner, who are responsible for that. And on the quantum information side, it's Witlof Wieczorek and Simon Grüblacher. So that's the team, and this is how discussions usually go in Austria. So with this, I would like to thank you very much for your attention.